Just a reminder, I want to make sure everyone is signed in on the signature pages. And then we're ready when you are, Counsel.
May it please the Court, I'm Henry McLaughlin, and I'm counsel for the appellate on Harris Andrews. I request to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes, yes, sir.
There are essentially two questions, fundamental questions in this case. The first question is whether or not the grievance process, where a grievance is mandated by law, whether a grievance can be defeated on grounds that it is not proper for a hearing examiner to find as a matter of fact and to hold that the party, that the employer subject to the grievance process acted in bad faith. The circuit court held that the grievance process did not allow a termination to be reversed on grounds of a holding and finding that the employer acted in bad faith.
Do you agree that the statute, Code Section 2.23005.1, for example, see the triple I, says that the ruling is binding if it's consistent with law and policy? That's the standard. That bad faith is not part of that.
Well, I submit that you can't act consistent with law and policy if you apply your policies in bad faith. You're not applying them consistent with law and policy if you're applying them in bad faith.
And on the policy side, help me with this one if you can. My understanding from the reading of our cases is that a grievance appeal has a tripartite relationship, and policy issues, to the extent that policy is involved, it's appealed not to the circuit court, but to the Department of Human Resource Management. Weren't there decisions made even in the circuit court on policy here? And if so, why wasn't there an appeal to the Department of Human Resource Management?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it has to do with the application of policy. That this case has to do with a bad faith application of policies. There's not a thing wrong with the policies of the grievance policy. There's nothing out of the ordinary, questionable at all. Neither side has questioned that these policies are correct. The issue is whether they followed the policies, and then one of the issues is whether there could be a following of the policies if they perverted them. They used language as a pretext to say they were following it when in fact they were acting in bad faith. And the hearing officer, after...
What case law, Mr. McLaughlin, can you help us with what case law you would cite as to why the circuit court doesn't have authority to reverse the hearing officer if it's on a matter that is an issue of law, contrary to law, that standard?
We don't contend that the circuit court has no authority to reverse a decision that is contrary to law. If a decision is contrary to law, then the circuit court had the right to reverse it.
But where's the bad faith come into that?
Well, the bad faith, if I understand the question correctly, is whether or not there are cases that say that use of bad faith is a violation of policy. And I don't know of any cases that say that, because I don't know if anybody's ever argued this before. I mean, I think this probably is a case of first impression. But to say that you are correctly applying your policies if you're using bad faith in doing so seems to me to be an oxymoron. That cannot be. That you can't properly apply your policies. You cannot properly apply your policies if you're acting in bad faith in pretending to do so. And she conducted a very long trial hearing. Went on multiple.
Can I just interrupt you there, because I'm trying to. I appreciate your helping me figure this out. You seem to be equating then written policies as an equivalent to a question of law, because if they violate the written policies, then that intones a question of bad faith or implies a question of bad faith, and therefore the circuit court would seem to be dealing with questions of law, whether it's quote-unquote written policy or question of the law that is written.
I hope I'm understanding your question. If the employer does not follow its rules, then that is grievable, and that is grievable under the law. And what I'm saying is that implicit in all of those policies is that they're being done in some sort of regular way, and it could not be anything any more irregular than doing it in bad faith. And that therefore it's a finding of the hearing officer that they did not follow their policies because they didn't use good faith in doing so. And I don't know of any cases that have held this. Certainly no cases held to the contrary, and I would submit that the likelihood is the reason this is the first time it's come before court, because I don't know of any case in which anybody's ever contended that you can have policies and use them as a pretext without any intent to act in any kind of good faith in applying.
Are you suggesting that it would be impossible for an employer to not breach the law or breach written policy if that employer were acting in bad faith? I mean, isn't it possible for an employer to act in bad faith, that is, with ill motives or whatever, but still comply with the law and written policy?
Well, I understand that question. Thinking is free. People can think anything they want to in this world, and there's nothing can be done about it.
That's right.
But if you act according to, and if your actions are according to bad intent and bad faith, they can have bad faith and not exercise, and not act in bad faith. That's the difference. She held that they acted in bad faith.
And that by definition, that means that they have acted contrary to the law or contrary
and the policies.
Policy.
And that you cannot carry out policies when you are acting in pretext of doing so in bad faith. And the examination of the facts of this case are quite remarkable. I mean, what happened here was this lady, and there was evidence, by the way, in this case, a former employer came and talked about what a good employee she was. There's plenty of evidence about her good record. But in this case, she was late. She tried to call her employer. She couldn't reach him. So she texted someone else to give him notice. It turns out, and she was disciplined for this, and it turns out that that her supervisor who disciplined her admitted at the trial that he had done the very same thing. And there was evidence that this, uncontroverted evidence, that this was not uncommon. And in fact, after the fact, he called a meeting and said, you can't do this. So she's not at fault for something that a rule was made after it was done. But he then waited a while, did a memorandum, a counseling memorandum, called her in and said, I'm going to hold this in my office. She was busy, she was running late, and she asked for more time to answer it. And the hearing officer found that she reasonably believed she had more time. That's a finding by the hearing officer entitled to some deference. And then she wrote a memorandum, which is in the record, which the hearing officer found was explanatory, not hostile, nothing out of the way about it, explaining her position. And as a result of that, this was escalated to something sent to everybody, put in her record, and made one of the grounds to fire her, and was given as the grounds, precipitating grounds to fire, by the party who actually initiated the firing. Now, there was a pretense that was...
Mr. McLaughlin, I hate to interrupt you, but as you know, time goes by so quickly on these arguments. I wanted to ask you about, in the termination letter, it referenced RRHA's policy number 1.6, separation and termination, and dealing with paragraph B in dismissal. And it stated, states, an employee may be terminated by RRHA for unsatisfactory work performance, misconduct, violation of RRHA policy, or any reason deemed sufficient by the RRHA. Employment with RRHA is at-will employment, which may be terminated by RRHA at any time for any reasons. Normally, at-will employment means you serve at the pleasure of your employer, essentially. Why, if it's at-will employment, is it subject to this grievance procedure?
Well, the law says it is. They have a policy for grievance based on the statute providing for grievances by this employer, and it is, I submit that that language is not consistent with the law or the grievance process, and that they cannot, I mean, that seems to be the position of RHA in this case, is that it doesn't make a particle of difference why they would fire her. Well, if that is so, then why does she get a grievance procedure at all? And there is a statute requiring the grievance procedure. And I submit that any time you have a grievance procedure where you can have an overview of the grounds for termination, it is not at will. And that's my answer to that.
You're in your rebuttal time, but you may continue if you
I'm
want.
I'm sorry I went so long with that specifics. Thank you very much.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Mitchell with McGuire Woods for RRHA. Jumping right to the point that Mr. McLaughlin was talking about in the bad faith element. In the briefs, I believe opposing counsel mentioned that there was no case directly on issue. As an initial matter, this whole grievance process stems from statute anyway, and unless it's expressly put in the statute in both in Code 2.2-3006 that Judge Huff referenced and also Code 15.2-1507, there is no mention of a bad faith element. In addition to that, this court's ruling in Virginia Department of State Police v. Barton, 39 Virginia App 439, sort of talked about and put the grievance process in context. The court recognized, quote, that the grievance process, quote, exists, quote, as a matter of legislative grace, and then went on to note that the guiding principle of the grievance procedure is that management reserves the exclusive right to manage the affairs and operations. So the simple fact is this grievance process and grievance procedure is not like a traditional labor law situation where you have a hearing officer determining whether, in the hearing officer's view, the management decision was the right one, if they should have done something different, or what they should have done. The hearing officer is limited.
Mr. Mitchell, can you go into, I want to follow up on Judge Huff's question to your opposing counsel earlier, and that is, how do you square the circuit court's actions when it makes certain made certain rulings where it talked about it was contrary to law and written policy, if the Department of Human Resources Management is supposed to be the final authority on policy questions and the circuit court only giving review on issues contrary to law?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I think with a quasi-public body like the RRHA, it's the executive director instead of the Department of Management Services that has that responsibility. And it also goes into the way the hearing officer was contradict, or the error of law that the hearing officer engaged in was that she did not contain her decision to the provisions of law and written policy. So the circuit court has to get into that issue to see if she complied with 15.2-1507, A10, A6. And so the circuit court was properly exercising its jurisdiction in considering the issue and making its opinion.
Because the hearing officer got into it, so it had to review it anyway. But can you elaborate a little bit on what you said just before that, where you said in this situation DHRM would not be the entity that would look at the policy question?
And I may be mistaken on that. I seem to recall that there is a provision with regard to the 15.2-1507 that it would go to the head person, whether it's the executive director, CEO, whatever that is of that entity.
Because it's a local government as opposed to state?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, it would go to the head of that group. And I believe it's in the statute. I don't have it directly in front of me.
To be the executive director of RRHA.
Yes, correct.
On the topic that Mr. McLaughlin was addressing toward the end of his opening argument, if this is a grievable situation, then it's not really an at-will employment, is it?
It is not at will for these reasons only. Did we comply with any of the requirements that are in our policy? In this case, RHA's termination policy 1.6 has a few minor requirements. They're cited in the brief. I believe you have to have the director of human resources or vice president of human resources involved, and that was done. I mean, it's very few direct requirements for that. Now, as you get to 1.3, is the court below found, and I think as the brief show, those are all discretionary, whether to enact progressive discipline or not, or whether to go straight to termination. Once you go to termination, you are now looking at the 1.6 only, which has very few requirements. It's undisputed that the company or that RHA met those requirements.
But those are policy matters, aren't they? That's an elaboration of what the policy is of Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority, and if it's a policy issue, it doesn't belong in the circuit court, does it?
Well, it does to the extent that the hearing officers required her legal duty to act within the law is to act consistent with policy and the law. And so that's in the statute. That's the legal duty. That's how it gets to the circuit court in that situation.
So your answer is that because the statute refers to written policy, that the court can look at that. Is that right?
Correct. The court can look to see if the hearing officer met his or her obligation under the statute to issue a decision that is consistent with law and policy. That is the legal requirement, and it's a legal issue that permits the court to look at the issue, and that's what the circuit court did in this situation.
Law and written policy.
Right? Yes, law and written policy, yes, Your Honor.
If it were not written policy, would it be different?
If it were not written policy, I'm sorry?
If it were just policy, a policy, but it's not written policy.
I don't think that the hearing officer would have authority to rule on that. They're limited to looking at the law and written policy and issuing a decision that's consistent with the same. This is not, the Virginia legislature necessarily prescribed the degree of review that was permitted to hearing officers in this case. And it was to look and see if it complies with the law and written policy. And for the reasons that are in the brief and for the reasons that the circuit court below determined, the hearing officer in this case, her decision did not comply with the law and written policy, and therefore the circuit court properly reversed the decision and held that Ms. Andrews' grievance should be denied. With that, Your Honor, any further questions?
There's none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. Rebuttal time, sir.
May it please the court, on the subject of the written policies, one of the issues which is addressed in his argument and which I would like to raise in rebuttal is the language in the policy itself, which says, and I would read, the purpose of this policy is to establish the standards of conduct for Richmond Redevelopment Housing Authority employees and to prescribe procedures for progressive discipline. The word prescribe is defined in the dictionary to include an official act, and that's the only application that
I'm sorry, where are you reading from, Mr. McLaughlin?
I'm reading from, it's on the Joint Appendix 972, and this is the policy for the RHA's written policy that's applicable, and it prescribes.
Isn't it section 1.3? I'm going by memory now. Oh, that's all right. That's all right. We're fine. Well, you've given us the page reference.
It is 972 in the joint appendix. And there was a considerable debate on this subject in all of the procedures below. This was argued on both sides at every stage. And the Housing Authority says that this is not mandatory, that it is discretionary. I submit it is mandatory. Prescribes means the only way definition of prescribed that is applicable here is an official rule, and that's mandatory. What they say is it's not mandatory because of the next sentence, which says, this policy establishes rules of progressive conduct, unacceptable workplace conduct, and corrective action procedures that may be imposed to address behavior and employment problems. And they focus on the word may. Well, if you say to somebody, this is what you have to do to impose discipline, and if you do this, then you may impose discipline. They may not impose discipline unless they follow their own rules, which are mandatory, and they require progressive discipline. The hearing officer went through this in great detail as to how they did not do that. And this is in addition to the fact that it's bad faith, but I come back to the fact that this whole grievance process becomes something that it's hard to understand how it has any meaning at all. Why lead somebody to pay for a lawyer? Why lead somebody to go through the time and trouble to do a grievance process if the policies and procedures don't have to be used in some sort of good faith? We're not talking here about doing it in a reasonable manner. We're not talking about here doing this in a fair manner, although the grievance can be on the grounds that it's an unfair misapplication of the rules and policies, and clearly that's what happened here. And she went into this in great detail as to how they acted in bad faith in firing this lady. They couldn't even say what the precipitating cause was. They gave three different answers to that question. What is the thing that caused her to be fired? They gave three different answers during the course of this. And the hearing officer showed that there was a pretext in the document itself. They even have in here something that one of the grounds for finding it was it had some suspicion. And this is a public employee. She's entitled to some due process. That's what the hearing officer found. And if they can fire somebody in bad faith, then what is the point of having any grievance procedure at all? Well, thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and then take up the last case of today's docket, which is Deshaies Stith versus the Commonwealth.